the story. Old when he wrote it down. About a newcomer to New York being shown the wonders of Wall Street. Down at the Battery, his guide showed him the handsome ships at anchor there, saying, "Look, those are the bankers' and brokers' yachts." The naive visitor asked, "Where are the customers' yachts?" "Where are the customers' yachts?" is the book's timeless title, and its message, too, is for the ages. The financial industry is not about making investors rich. Stated that way, it sounds a little obvious, and maybe even too cynical. After all, people do tend to make money in the stock market. And most financial advisors and brokers are honest. That's why people like Bernie Madoff make headlines. He was a spectacular exception. Besides, the government protects us. Right? Here is an astonishing fact. Serving your needs, until recently, came second under the law. The Obama administration had to create a rule that requires brokers to put your interests first. Like so many of the regulations passed during the Obama administration, the future of the fiduciary rule is unclear. It is, unsurprisingly, very unpopular with the financial services and insurance industries. Several lawsuits were filed as soon as the regulations were issued in April 2016. Efforts to undermine or overturn it continue, but the rule went into partial effect in June 2017. The Trump administration has delayed enforcement of the rule. So it's too soon to tell what will happen to the rule, but it might survive. And in any case, you should know what it tried to do, because it shows one of the seamier parts of the investing world. Until 2016, most brokers were required by law to recommend only suitable investments. That loose standard allowed them to, for example, flog a mutual fund that has relatively high fees and pays them a fat commission, instead of a cheaper alternative that might better serve the needs of the customer. Investment advisors who register with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, with state agencies, or the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, are already held to a higher standard. Foisting less helpful financial products on the customer isn't outright fraud, but it's not helpful either. The Obama administration estimated that these practices cost consumers about $18 billion a year and cut their returns by a full percentage point. When it comes to retirement funds, a percentage point over time is a lot. So the administration came up with new fiduciary regulations to protect consumers and to help them get the best financial deal for their money. The rule, which took 6 years to develop, does not apply to all investments, but only to retirement accounts with tax advantages like 401ks and IRAs. It would reshape the way that most brokers are paid, favoring fees over commissions. It is expected to drive more customers toward lower-cost investments, like the kind of low-fee index funds that are already dominating the industry. What does this all mean to you? If you decide to go with a broker, say your brother-in-law has someone he thinks is terrific, and your brother-in-law drives a Porsche, just keep in mind that the broker might not have your best interests at heart. And where are the customers' Porsches? Look them up on BrokerCheck, brokercheck.finra.org, which is run by FINRA and helps you find out whether a broker has been in trouble before, whether they have had any penalties or prosecutions, been fired for cause, or have other marks on their record. You might be surprised how many do. You can find out about investment advisors at the SEC's Investment Advisor Public Disclosure site, advisorinfo.sec.gov. The listings aren't perfect. Some brokers get complaints expunged, so you don't get a warning. But it's better than nothing. And you also might be surprised by the kinds of complaints that you find on broker reports. While I was casting about for brokers to talk with for this chapter, BrokerCheck showed me one guy with 7 disclosures since 2000, 4 of them involving settlements or judgments over claims of being sold unsuitable investments, with payouts totaling about $100,000. FINRA, the regulatory group, suspended 727 brokers in 2016 and banned 517. If you haven't figured it out yet, I'm pretty skeptical of people who get a commission on the financial packages they sell, especially when the industry fought hard against the fiduciary rule. So, unless you find a broker you feel great about, I'd recommend going with a fee-only financial advisor and certified financial planners. Those folks are already required by law to be fiduciaries. They were obligated to serve your best interests before the Obama administration ever tried to apply the standard to brokers. You can find them through the nonprofit Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, as well as the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors and the Financial Planning Association. Each group makes it easy to search for an advisor online. The difference between brokers and fiduciaries can be explained as the difference between a butcher and a dietitian, a distinction laid out in an amusing 2012 video from Hightower Advisors. In it, the company explains through a whiteboard animation that a butcher wants to sell you meat, maybe great meat, but the game is selling you meat. A dietitian is going to recommend a more balanced diet, with your health in mind. No matter what kind of salesperson or advisor you go with, you need to shop smart. You need to ask tough questions of anyone who wants to take on the job and the reward of handling your money. And you might consider getting whoever you decide to go with to sign a fiduciary pledge, like the one published by the Committee for the Fiduciary Standard. It could buy you a little peace of mind. Puts the advisor on notice that you are paying attention to your rights and might even help you if you have a dispute that goes to arbitration. Ron Lieber, the New York Times personal finance columnist, recommends asking any would-be broker or advisor 21 questions about themselves and whatever financial product they are suggesting that you buy. The questions are mostly ways of finding out whether the advisor is acting in your best interest and how many ways you might be milked for fees and commissions. They include, how much money will you personally make in cash commission now if I select this product? And are you earning more from selling me this product than you might from putting me in a similar product from a different company? I really like Ron, but I get the feeling selling anything at all to him, annuities, a house, Girl Scout cookies, could be a nightmare. He's tough. He's also right. Asking questions, even uncomfortable questions, is the way to go. And yet even Ron, for all his advice about vetting advisors, found himself working with a guy who would later be charged with stealing millions of dollars from vulnerable clients. The advisor did not steal anything from Ron, but Ron confessed to being stunned to find that an advisor he trusted could be a thief. I thought I knew what I was doing, he told his readers in a great column. So if I can get mixed up in something like this, trust me, it can happen to anyone. Undeterred, I go looking for financial advice and a free meal. So here I am, educating myself on these issues at last. Reading, talking to experts. And bit by bit, I am making progress. In college, though, I always seemed to get more out of the lectures than the reading. I wondered about whether it might be possible to get a boost in my financial knowledge by hearing experts speak on the topic. But where do you find a financial expert giving a lecture? As it happens, just about anywhere. I was in luck. And you probably are too. At our house, we often get cards and flyers in the mail offering free investment seminars, often with the come-on of a free meal. You are cordially invited, John Schwartz, to attend a dinner event in Fairfield. Of course, no charge or obligation. Or complimentary gourmet lunch, making the most of Social Security. Now, in my experience, no free meal is ever really free. I've passed up many offers of free trips to explore the exciting world of timeshare condos. Now that I'm actually planning for retirement, however, I thought maybe I should see what an investment advisor has to say. I sorted through the recent invites and found a flyer for a seminar sponsored by Wrightbridge Financial Group. The company offered a groundbreaking educational event, promising fundamental financial strategies in the new economy, with the opportunity to learn about retirement planning, reducing taxes, and why getting a second opinion might be the most important financial decision of your life. I hadn't heard of the company, but I had heard of the venue for the seminar, Bloomfield Steak and Seafood House. It's got good reviews, and I'd never eaten there before. The use of scare quotes and the two-word groundbreaking irked my inner copy editor, but I could live with that. I looked up the leader of the seminar, whose first name is Keith, on brokercheck.finra.org, and his record was clean. The site also showed that he had only formed the firm in 2014 after 5 years at New York Life. So we weren't looking at an investment advisor with decades of experience. But a young gun might have interesting ideas, and it couldn't hurt to listen. Also, I wanted to try that steakhouse. So I signed up. The day before the seminar, a representative of the firm called to ask me some questions, because her boss likes to tailor his presentation to the needs of the guests, she said. Was I retired? Was there anything specific I wanted to learn about? This made it sound like a one-on-one experience. I asked how many people would be getting steak with me. She told me 45 people had signed up. I explained that I didn't have any specific questions and that I was pretty clueless. All true. I just want to hear what he's telling people, I said. I would not need special attention. The night of the seminar, I arrived at the appointed time, 6:30 p.m., and was sent upstairs to a big dining room tucked into the top floor. Six rows of long tables faced a podium and a screen. I was not the youngest person there, and certainly not the oldest. There were pitchers of soda and ice water on the table. The server stopped by to ask what I'd be having. Most of the people around me were ordering prime rib, but I asked her what she liked. The prime rib is great, but it's just a piece of meat, she said. She suggested the chicken francaise, or even one of the salmon or pasta dishes. I said yes to the chicken, even though Anthony Bourdain famously wrote that chicken is what chefs put on the menu for customers who can't decide what they want to eat. The representative from the firm who had called me, and who had also taken attendance, stepped to the front, welcomed us, and introduced Keith, briefly giving his credentials. As of today, he has a 100% approval rating. She said he would be speaking for 50 minutes, which turned out to be the first stretched truth moment of the evening. The presentation would go on for an hour and a half, and the food would not show up until he was done. Keith took the mic and launched into his talk. He turned out to be a lively speaker. He opened with a slide of himself in a baseball uniform at the age of 8. Cute kid, which let him tell us about his childhood, his love of baseball, his days as a player in college. He told us about his father, who worked in construction on local projects, including a number of Simon Malls. His father, he told us, was injured on a construction site and was in a coma for 3 months. His mother, who had been a bond transfer agent for E.F. Hutton, asked a financial advisor what to do. He warned her not to take money out of their investments. "What I learned from that was the impact of money," he said soberly. "Did they come out of it okay? Did they lose their shirts?" He didn't say. His life story, long on emotion but short on information, then led to the end of his baseball career in his senior year of college, when he fractured his spine. "There's a message in that," he said. "Tonight, we're going to talk about the things we can't control." "Well, okay, that's a pretty good moral to the story so far, but what do we do about it?" "You thought you would be here tonight and somebody was going to try to sell you some kind of annuity," he said. "But there's not going to be any selling here tonight. Instead, he wanted to talk about character, which must have something to do with that slide of the adorable kid in the baseball uniform. He then ran through a series of slides showing the various levels of a house, and he talked through a complicated metaphor for the kinds of investments he sees on each floor. The steady savings account is the basement. The roof is the most volatile. Anything that can lose value in the stock market. As you age, you need less stuff in that volatile attic and more stuff in the stable lower parts of the house. He warned that your broker is probably screwing you with hidden fees and mutual funds. He had an older couple stand up and ask the man his age. When the man replied 63, Keith gave a big MC's grin and said, "You look great for 63. What are you eating? I gotta come over." He had them hold a tape measure between them to show that we're trying to stretch our retirement savings to a longer life than we may be planning for. It was a lot of metaphors and warnings, but it wasn't easy to see what he was trying to really say. Except this. I'm an engaging guy. If you like me, we can structure your retirement funds together, which, ultimately, is not a bad way to market yourself to people who aren't financial experts. Keith then introduced a lawyer who talked about the rookie mistakes that people, and even some lawyers, make in setting up wills, and the other documents that dictate whether your death will mean a smooth inheritance for your heirs or a legal mess. He gave a quick look at estate taxes at the federal level and in New Jersey. Good with examples, he created entertaining scenarios about the wills of a couple named Tony and Carmella. And so, of course, we need to protect the inheritance of the kids, Meadow and AJ. That's right. He led this New Jersey audience through New Jersey estate law using the Sopranos as his hypothetical couple. And it worked. It was nearly 8 p.m. by then, and the only food in sight was a basket of rolls at the far end of my long table, too far to reach. I worried about the rudeness of asking people to pass them down. My stomach rumbled. The lawyer ended his talk. Keith stepped back up with a handout purporting to show the difference between two portfolios. He noted that one had only a slightly lower return on paper than the other, but he said that it will produce greater returns. The one with a slightly lower rate, he explained, has much lower volatility and risk, so the buyer will end up richer for it. The guy next to me shook his head with irritation, muttering that these sheets didn't say anything useful. What were these funds? What companies were in them? Were the earnings histories reflected accurately? These might be useful as a hypothetical description of investing issues, but there's no telling whether these sheets were tied to anything in the real world. Keith finished by 8:11. "We hope we did a good enough job so you decide we should be your advisors," he said. Everyone had been given a form letting us say whether we wanted to be contacted in the coming days. "Don't sign if you're not serious," he said. "The calendar is very booked. Your time is very valuable. So is ours." Tara came by to pick up the sheets and eyed the check mark to see who wanted to follow up. Once she flicked her gaze over my check mark on the do not follow up side, she stiffened a little and quickly moved on. I was, for Keith and company, a wasted investment in a meal. What the industry derisively calls a plate licker. The entrees came at last. My chicken was not bad. The mashed potatoes were good and garlicky. And by then, I was so hungry that it seemed like one of the best meals of my life. I struck up a conversation with the guy next to me, the one who had disliked the comparison of the two hypothetical funds. He attends a fair number of free seminars, he told me, but not as many as a friend who eats out on investment advisors all the time. "Why?" I asked. "He wanted free meals," my neighbor explained. "He and his buddy," he said, "talk investments recreationally." My new buddy was named Dan, and he was married. "I dragged my wife to one other seminar," he told me. "That one had the food first. This format," he said, "would not have pleased her. She would have hated waiting for the food, he said. And when the staffer came around to sign people up for appointments, Dan took one, surprising me a little. Hadn't you been skeptical, I asked? What about the meaningless comparison sheets? Just to check the asset mix, he said. It will be good to have an intelligent conversation. The evening was not a bust. It was not the sleazy hard sell session I'd been dreading, but it also wasn't terribly helpful either. The picture of Keith in a baseball uniform was cute, but I still didn't see what that had to do with moving away from retail brokerage firms and into what he referred to as his more personal investing approach, about which I still knew very little. In the weeks after attending the seminar, I looked around to see what financial regulators and experts had to say about the practice. Most of what I found were warnings against accepting the free meal. FINRA issued a strong warning about the practice in an alert titled Free Lunch Investment Seminars, Avoiding the Heartburn of a Hard Sell, because even financial regulators aren't above bad puns. We are issuing this alert because, in many cases, free meal investment seminars are not solely about education, the group wrote. Their ultimate goals are to recruit new clients and sell products. And while some pitches can be easy to swallow, the consequences can be hard to bear. Cue the spooky music. The seminars are common, the group found. According to its own 2013 survey, 64% of those responding to the survey who were 40 or older had been offered a meal seminar, and nearly a third said they had attended one. Just 4 lost any money because of these seminars, the regulator said. That's apparently not for lack of trying on the part of those putting on the seminars. FINRA found that in half of its examinations of seminars, the materials made claims that appeared to be exaggerated, misleading, or otherwise unwarranted. Worse, 13% of the seminars appeared to involve fraud. FINRA suggested that anyone going for a free dinner and a money talk should understand that even though the company might insist it isn't trying to sell you anything, it is, whether during that meal or during the follow-up personal session that they almost inevitably recommend. The alert also suggested checking out the broker involved at brokercheck.finra.org, where I had looked up Keith. The North American Securities Administrators Association also issued a warning, even more sharply worded. There's a certain consistency to the invitation's enticements. A free gourmet meal. Tips on how to earn excellent returns on your investments. Eliminate market risk. Grow your retirement funds. And spouses are urged to attend. These words should be red flags for investors. That alert listed prosecutions in Missouri, Utah, Colorado, and California, in which con artists and unlicensed brokers were ripping off gullible senior citizens by recommending that the customers sell off their holdings to invest in fancy financial products offered by the seller. These products are often grossly unsuitable for senior citizens. State securities regulators are seeing a variety of violations associated with many of these seminars, ranging from outright lies and the conversion of investor funds to more sophisticated forms of abuse. One agent told seniors that due to his skills, one of his clients could now afford to take 3 vacations a year and had invited him and his family to join the client on vacation. In truth, the client with whom the agent vacationed was his father. They advise anyone who does go for the free meal to hold on to your skepticism, ask tough questions, and don't make rash financial decisions. If you don't understand it, don't buy it. And if you do get taken for a ride, report it. I felt that Keith was not one of the bad guys. And, like my neighbor that evening, I got the feeling that I could have a decent discussion with him about investment strategies. But I'm not sorry I didn't ask for the follow-up consultation. Keith got to write off my free meal, and I got to write off Keith. Seems fair. Speed Dating 1. A Financial Advisor. I decided to talk with more brokers and advisors. First, I tried Daniel P. Weiner, the chief executive of Advisor Investments, a company in Newton, Massachusetts, that manages more than $4 billion in assets for individuals. But he also has a popular and rambunctious monthly newsletter, The Independent Advisor for Vanguard Investors, which provides information on Vanguard funds. He is not a financial advisor himself, but has them on his staff. "I'm an investment guy," he said. The day that I called, he agreed to wear both hats for a bit. He told me that the very first thing he asks people when they start talking about retirement is whether they have any sort of illness or serious medical condition. "If you're reasonably healthy," he told me, "you have to plan on living to 100. If you're planning for anything less than that, you're at risk." "If I were to plan that way and get sick later," he said, "say, prostate cancer at 70, I could adjust the plan. Planning for 100? He'd out-bogled Bogle." Making a financial plan, he explained, is art and not science, as a look at the various investment companies' target retirement funds shows. The ratios of stocks to bonds and cash, not to mention the types of stocks and bonds, is all over the place, he said, and they don't take individual needs into account. Noting that he and I were the same age, he asked why we would expect the Vanguard 2025 target fund would be right for both of us, with our very different lives. He had blunt words about the trend toward index investing. As he put it, "Don't listen to all this indexing bullshit. I've got some excellent managers to recommend." His advisors help clients beat the indexes, he said, and invest in the same funds and strategies themselves. "We eat our own cooking," he said proudly, "and they make their money through fees on the assets under management." Mr. Weiner then agreed to take an informal look at my Vanguard portfolio. I emailed him my list of funds, and he got back to me within minutes with a thorough and embarrassing vetting. One of the main things that he noticed was that I had a retirement target fund that seemed to violate his advice about pushing off retirement targets to 2025 or even 2030. He wrote succinctly, "Target 2020? Ew!" I couldn't remember why I'd set the target 2020 as my retirement in the fund. I'm not planning to retire in 2 years. What was I thinking? Well, we know what I was thinking. I was not thinking. He also noticed that I had a silly 1% of my portfolio in one fund. "Why?" he asked. Again, I had no idea, though I figured it was something left over from an earlier transaction. Frankly, I couldn't remember buying that fund. He said I should be putting at least 10 to 15% of my allocation into foreign stocks, citing some Vanguard options, and urged me to put 5% of my portfolio into healthcare stocks, suggesting Vanguard's healthcare fund. Finally, he argued that I should dump my investment in Vanguard's Windsor Fund, a managed fund. He said that I should be going outside Vanguard for my managed stock investing and recommended Prime Cap's Odyssey Growth Fund for 25% of my stock holdings. "He puts a lot of his own family's money into that fund," he told me. "That's a start," he concluded. Bracing. Speed Dating 2. A Broker. Next, I decided to try a retail broker who works on commission. These are the folks whom experts warn investors to be careful with, since they make money by selling you investments. Remember Ron Lieber's list of 21 questions for any broker? I called the investment services branch of a local bank that offers a free initial consultation and was transferred to a guy named Gary. I told him that I was looking for a checkup on my investments and retirement plans, and he said he could see me that day. 20 minutes later, we were shaking hands. He was pleasant and easy to talk to, and it turned out we were the same age. He was pleased that I'd started saving in my late 20s and seemed to think that the $1.2 million that the 401k had grown to was a goodly sum, though he said he wouldn't know if it was enough to count on for retirement until we'd gone over our current expenses and what we expected to spend in retirement. He handed me a 10-page financial planning profile. The form, he said, will help me get a good idea of where you stand, how much you're going to need in retirement. We can see if you'll have a surplus or negative. Flipping through it, I saw it asked many of the same questions I'd encountered on the Vanguard website, but with greater detail. They wanted my recent pay stubs, bank and 401k statements, cash flow, including cable and internet bills, medical costs, assets, and debts. It also took on some of the big questions, such as when we plan to retire, and how long we expected to live, as well as, do you want to leave a legacy? He said I didn't have to fill out every bit of it in detail, and it did not constitute the last word. Once we plug everything in, we can adjust it, he said, anytime there's an event in your life that requires it. After handing that to me, he talked about his mother, who needed years of long-term 24-hour care at home. That, he said, was something we'd be talking about once I signed up for an account, whether I'd like to get long-term care insurance. He had subtly slipped into a pitch. Long-term care insurance tends to be expensive, but the company offers what he said was a hybrid account called MoneyGuard from Lincoln Financial Group. He quickly described it as a kind of insurance policy for long-term health care that I'd pay into with a large upfront chunk, say $50,000, though he said one of his clients was putting in more than 10 times that much. Beyond that would be monthly additions to the fund, which could be leveraged for a much greater amount of money available for long-term care. At the end of my life, if I didn't need to dip into the fund for long-term care, the investment would be available to my heirs, plus a 1 or 1.5% investment earnings. You'd get more money than you'd put into it. In the example of his client putting in $580,000, he said, there would be $1.75 million available for care, or the $580,000 if she died without needing the care. I think that's a great product, he said. He then handed me a 1-page form to assess my health to see if I'd qualify for the insurance. I asked him if he would take a look at the funds I had with Vanguard to see whether they were good choices, and he gave them a quick once-over and said that they looked good to him. These are great. I asked him about the 2020 target retirement fund that Weiner had scoffed at, and he said that he had one with the same target date, too. You're fine. That's conservative, he said. He didn't notice the silly 1% investment in that T. Rowe Price fund that bothered Weiner, but it was pretty clear that he intended to move me into a different set of investments entirely if I decided to work with him. He said that he would probably recommend some funds offered through his company that would be equivalent to what I had at Vanguard, and that I would benefit because there would be no 12B1 charges on his funds. We have something about the same, and we could take out the fees. He asked me to complete the financial planning profile so we could get started, and we shook hands and said goodbye. The visit had taken less than an hour. It was a good visit, with a pleasant, likable guy. I got home and looked up some of what we talked about. I started with his record on BrokerCheck. He'd been in the business for 22 years with just one potential blemish on his record, from 2001. A customer alleged that Gary had gotten him into an unsuitable bond purchase. The claim was denied. In other words, it appeared that his reputation was pretty clean. Some of the things he said in our conversation, however, did not add up. The hybrid funds might not be as great as he said. There's been plenty written about hybrid funds like MoneyGuard. These hybrids, which act like something between an insurance policy and an annuity, can help you avoid big fee hikes that can come with traditional long-term care insurance, but they cost a lot up front. If you've got plenty of money to put aside in such funds, they can bring peace of mind. So long as you pump enough in to get a substantial amount of coverage. A $50,000 kick-in might make the broker a nice fee, but it wasn't going to pay for much long-term care. An article in Kiplinger suggested that while the hybrids are popular, investors could do better by investing the money and getting market rate returns, or simply buying both long-term care insurance and life insurance. I also looked up 12b-1 fees to find out what they were. They are fees charged on mutual funds of as much as 1% a year. They've been around forever and cut into your investment, and so they are unpopular. I checked my Vanguard funds to see if any of them charge 12b-1 fees. They don't. Speed Dating 3. An hourly fee, financial advisor. Finally, I looked into the world of investment advisors who charge by the hour, not by a percentage of your assets. For that, I sought out Tom Fredrickson. He is a member of the Garrett Planning Network, an organization of hundreds of planners who work on a fee-only basis. Fredrickson works by the hour. Setting up a financial plan can cost between $1,200 and $4,000, according to his website, with the percentage paid annually for ongoing asset management. Smaller jobs cost less. College planning can run about $500 per child. Reviewing a portfolio can run anywhere from about $500 to $1,500. You get the idea. I was drawn to the simplicity of the services that people like Fredrickson offer. I got in touch and we exchanged a few emails discussing his services and what he would do for us if we became clients. He sent me a worksheet that would show our assets and a spreadsheet that could help us see what we spend our money on. For many people, a crucial first step is getting our heads around what their spending habits are like, he said. With an understanding of income and spending, he can go on to show how much discretionary income there is to meet financial goals like saving for college or retirement. His average client's investable income is about $700,000, with clients at the high end in the mid-seven figures. I decided not to go for the full $4,000 treatment. I told him about the book project and asked if he would be willing to look over the same page of investments that the other guys had. He told me that he would give me an informal assessment for the cost of a lunch near his office in Brooklyn. How could I pass up that deal? We met over a couple of excellent lamb burgers in a place near his office by Prospect Park, and he started off by explaining what he does for a living. I actually do a full range of planning, from portfolio, if that's what somebody wants or needs, to a holistic plan, which might include college funding, managing cash flow, saving for retirement, the works. Life is more complicated than just having a portfolio, he told me. I think people benefit from having a complete look at everything. He said he likes for his clients to have him take an occasional checkup on their investments to make sure that, for example, the balance of stocks and bonds is about right, and whether the tax implications of investments are favorable. These are people who generally don't like to do the trading themselves, who like a real person they can talk to, and not an 800 number. One of the common services he provides is helping figure out where money is supposed to come from when a client wants something fairly big, like a house remodeling. Do you pull it out of a 401k? Spend down some investments? Take out a home equity loan? He helps them figure out when to start taking Social Security. Delaying is better because the payout is so much higher. Sometimes he's almost a therapist, he said. When a client wanted to draw down a substantial amount of money to renovate his brownstone so that he could make money off it through Airbnb, Fredrickson showed him that wasn't a good investment. The client had to admit that, aside from the financial rationalizations, he really just wanted to spiff up the place, and Fredrickson explained that he could help him find a way to pay for that. But the client should be thinking about the day, say, in his 80s, when he would be smart to sell the house. He is a fee-only financial planner, he said, because he wants to eliminate all possibility of conflict of interest. I like to describe myself to prospective clients as a consultant, he said. He will, on an hourly basis, determine a client's tolerance for risk and set out financial goals, recommending along the way the lowest fee funds. He favors index funds and retirement target funds, and he tells clients how to do that part themselves. I often talk clients out of my being an active investment manager, telling them, you can do it yourself. He said that after looking at the worksheet I had completed for him, which he'd brought in a plastic binder, I was in pretty good shape, especially when so many people have only Social Security to look forward to. Along with our 401k, that $30,000 pension is like an ace in the hole, he said. It's like doubling your Social Security right there. As long as we didn't pull out more than, say, 3 to 4% of our 401k investments per year, we should do pretty well, getting maybe $90,000 a year. It's not a luxurious retirement, but it's comfortable. He recommended still that we max out our contributions to the 401k, noting that we could be adding thousands of dollars to it each year beyond our current contribution. He then took a look at the same investments that the broker and Weiner had looked at, and had suggestions. He smiled a little at my stake in the Vanguard Windsor Fund, the one Weiner had also scoffed at. Windsor was once a high flyer, he said. The performance happens to be not as good lately. We were, he said, too heavily invested in big companies in the United States, the S&P 500, and would do well to get more small capitalization stocks and beef up the bonds a bit. The easiest way to do that, he suggested, was to move a lot of my current investments into one of the Vanguard target funds set for the year I expect to retire. A simple, good way to clean up the portfolio. It would do the diversifying and balancing for me, he said. As for the 2020 fund that I had invested in, and which Weiner had ridiculed, he said, it's okay if that's when you plan to retire, with the implication that if I expected to hold on more than 3 additional years in the working world, I could push the target date back by getting into another fund. After my experiences in the advice world, I was pretty much back where I started. I didn't hand over all my finances to anyone to rework, but I got some good advice and some questionable advice on my portfolio. I'll stick with Vanguard, but will follow Weiner's and Fredrickson's advice to get rid of the Windsor Fund. That fee is comparatively high, and the return, historically, isn't so great. But I'm not going to go for the outside managed funds that Weiner was describing, nor was I going to switch investment companies because I hired an advisor who works for one. And I guess I'll side with Warren Buffett on this one, Mr. Weiner. Sorry, but I still believe in that indexing bullshit. I also realized that I did not want a full-scale takeover of my finances at what felt to me like a high cost, as good as it sounded. Having stumbled my way into a reasonably good retirement plan, I didn't see a need to spend that kind of money. That may be penny-wise and pound-foolish, and you, listener, might want to consider a different path. I could see fee-only advisors as a great way for someone with a good income who is starting out in life to make sure things are in good order, or for someone looking at retirement to get a thorough checkup. A few hours after getting back from lunch, a friend sent an email around to me and some other friends asking if we knew of a good financial planner, someone to save me from financial ruin and or achieve total prosperity. Without hesitation, I gave him Fredrickson's number. Punch list. How to pick an investment advisor. So you want to find someone to help you with your investments. Here's how to do it. 1. Figure out what kind of help you need and what kind of advisor you're looking for. If you just want to play the stock market, you can hire a broker or trade online. Many brokers also offer financial planning and retirement planning. But if you want all-around financial planning, retirement, investing, and other aspects of your money life, go for a Certified Financial Planner, or CFP. You can find them through the websites of organizations like the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, the XY Planning Network, and the Garrett Planning Network. But also, get advice from respected family members and friends. If you don't need something as extensive as total asset management or comprehensive financial planning, you might not need an actual human. The growing field of so-called robo-advisors from sites like Betterment.com and Wealthfront.com cost less than flesh-and-blood advisors. They also do less, without the personalized service you'd expect from, well, a person. You get what you pay for, but it might be enough. The advisor I worked with at Vanguard was, essentially, acting as a mouthpiece for a robo-advisor. 2. Figure out how you want to pay your advisor. Many brokers and advisors make commissions on the products they sell. That can be a recipe for a conflict of interest. Others make their money directly through customer fees. You pay, whether on an hourly basis or an annual basis, or as a percentage of the assets they manage for you, and ask if they've ever been disciplined or prosecuted. 3. Make sure whoever will be working for you will really be working for you and not for a beach house. You might get great service from a broker, but you'll want to make sure that professional is acting with your best interests at heart. Be ready to ask a lot of questions along those lines. Ask for the names of other clients who might vouch for him or her, how the firm is compensated, and about any financial incentives to recommend some financial products over others. You can find a good list of such questions at the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors website, or you can work from Ron Lieber's list. And be explicit about the advisor's fiduciary duty to you. Anyone you work with should be willing to sign an oath to serve your interests, like the one published by the Committee for the Fiduciary Standard. 4. Check anyway. Go to BrokerCheck, brokercheck.finra.org, to find out about past infractions by brokers. For a broader search that includes advisors, double-check at the Investment Advisor Public Disclosure site, advisorinfo.sec.gov, run by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Chapter 5. Houses. My house is me, and I am it. My house is where I like to be, and it looks like all of my dreams. Daniel Pinkwater, The Big Orange Splot. When our kids were little, we loved reading the works of Daniel Pinkwater, the off-kilter writer who can be funny, insightful, and magical all at once. A children's book of his that we came back to again and again was The Big Orange Splot, which is basically about uptight people on a neat street who become agitated when Mr. Plumbeam goes a little wild with a decorating project. A seagull drops a can of orange paint on the roof, and, well, things get wacky. The neighbors complain, one by one, to Mr. Plumbeam, and he replies to each of them, "My house is me, and I am it. My house is where I like to be, and it looks like all of my dreams." I could feel Plumbeam's simple self-confidence and pride in his home. I was moved, too, by the infectiousness of his argument. The neighbors who complain to him end up redoing their own houses. By the end, it is no longer a neat street. It is a sweetly wild fantasy of self-expression, and, as the neighbors put it, it looks like all our dreams. That ending has always choked me up. Okay, I'm an easy weeper. And don't ask me about Barbara Cooney's lovely little tales of island boys and lupine-strewing adventurers. I couldn't get through those without a good sniffle. Anyway, the point here is that I always wanted our own homes to reflect our family's personality, at least up to the point that it interferes with resale value. I'm sorry, Joseph. I know you wanted your bedroom in Millburn to have purple walls with polka dots, but we ended up having enough trouble selling the place as it was. That attitude meant that the kids got to choose the colors of their rooms, within reason. That purple room? Nope, nope, nope. And the light fixtures. The furniture tended to be cheap or second-hand, and we made good use of the stuff Sam made in high school woodshop. The delighted teacher even gave us an extra end table when he realized that, unlike many of the parents in our snooty town, we actually wanted the stuff. The art on the walls is, as I've said, eclectic. Those big oil paintings my folks picked up in New Orleans, my 50-year-old certificate from Supermen of America, the L-shaped corner-hugging painting of a tiger by Jean's dad. Suspended from the ceiling, a wire sculpture of an owl that Sam created in middle school. The cowboy boots from when I was 5 years old, bronzed. So, our houses, we've owned four over the years, have, to some extent, looked like all our dreams. But any homeowner knows that they also reflect our nightmares. The endless punch list of repairs, each with its own financial hit. We know the sense of dread that burbles up within us whenever we hear the sound of water dripping, or of squirrels scrabbling in the attic. And over it all, and tied to it all, is needing to pay for the privilege of staying in the damned place. Like most homeowners, we have found it to be a struggle at times. We've made mistakes and had bad luck, and learned from both. The subsequent choices we made when it came to buying homes were better, and provided us with a tidy profit when selling. For most of us out there, our houses are our biggest investment. The primary residence makes up 62% of the median homeowner's total assets, according to a 2013 report from the National Association of Home Builders. But buying a home is no guarantee of a good return on your investment. Sell profitably, and a house can push you into a more comfortable life. But if the value drops, remember the mid-2000s, you can be ruined. The hoary rule of thumb says that housing costs should be about 30% of your annual income. Many experts say that the rule is not ironclad. For one thing, income amount counts. Families making, say, $500,000 a year have more money left over after spending 30% of their income on housing than someone who earns $20,000 a year. For another, those higher-priced housing markets might come with job opportunities not available elsewhere. David Bieri, an associate professor of urban affairs at Virginia Tech, told Bloomberg News that despite its long use by the U.S. government as a standard of housing affordability, the 30% figure is essentially an arbitrary number that creates more distortions than it actually solves. But whether it's reasonable or not, the fact is that many of us spend more than that 30%, according to surveys conducted by the U.S. Census. Among homeowners, in 2014, more than 34% paid more than that magic 30%. More than half of renters were spending at least 30%, in part, the survey found, because many renters couldn't qualify for mortgages or come up with a down payment on a home. According to Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, the pressures on renters are fierce, with 21.3 million renters paying more than 30% of their income on housing, and 11.4 million of those households paying more than half of their incomes for housing, according to the group's 2016 State of the Nation's Housing Report, which is based on 2014 survey figures. The center called that a record high. Unsurprisingly, among those with the lowest income, $15,000 per household, things are even tougher, whether people rent or own, according to the Harvard study. 83% of these folks paid more than 30% of their income for housing in the 2014 survey, and a huge portion of those people pay more than half of their income on housing. 72% of renters and 66% of owners. Did you catch that seeming bright spot about the benefits of owning a home in the picture portrayed by the Harvard report? A smaller portion of homeowners than renters were paying more than 50% of their income, the category referred to as severely burdened. Even those paying more than 30%, known more gently as cost burdened, seem to be doing better than the renters. And the rate has been steadily dropping. By 2014, there were 18.5 million cost-burdened owners, down by 4.4 million since 2008. But in this segment of the economy, even the good news is bad. Fewer homeowners are in the severely burdened category because so many people who used to be in that category lost their homes through foreclosure. The nation's financial collapse is still being felt. Mortgage credit is still tight, and foreclosures continue, though not at the torrid rate as in the late aughts. So the Harvard report tells us that the national rate of homeownership dropped from 69% at the peak in 2004 to 63.7% in 2015. Housing prices didn't recover from the crash until 2016. Which brings us to the subprime mortgage crisis and Michael Lewis's astonishing book, The Big Short. The subprime loans boomed so that more people could buy homes, and Wall Street could generate more fees and trade more bonds based on the mortgages. As we all have since found out, it was a bubble. It burst in a way that makes the Bikini Atoll nuclear tests look kind of puny. Lewis talked about the disaster that awaited the subprime mortgage market in the 2000s. Borrowers who couldn't afford their homes facing steep mortgage cost hikes when their initial teaser rate that was fixed for 2 years expired. These borrowers, he wrote, were already one broken refrigerator away from default. And the teaser rates on the masses of lousy mortgages issued in 2005 were set to expire in 2007. They did, and were still climbing back from the economic collapse that resulted. The problem is that it's not just subprime borrowers who are one broken refrigerator away from default. Remember the Federal Reserve report that said 46% of Americans say they couldn't come up with an emergency expense costing $400 without borrowing money or selling something? People with less income, predictably, are even more fragile. Two-thirds of them would have trouble coming up with that $400. And, by the way, $400 is getting off easy. The wood in that lovely bay window in the kitchen turns out to have been rotted by leaks. Thousands of dollars to replace it, my friend. A worn-out roof that needs full replacement? Aye. Still, I was haunted by the words of Simcha Kravitz to his grandson, Duddy, in Mordecai Richler's great novel, The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz. The old man says, "A man without land is nobody." Richler's Duddy becomes pathological, a greedy hustler who betrays his friends. But even as I shook my head at Duddy, whether in print or played on screen by an incredibly young Richard Dreyfuss, the idea that owning land makes you somebody tugged at me. Jean and I had rented places since we first started dating in 1975. We found apartments in complexes that were about to be condemned. Portions of houses with floors so tilty that a marble placed on the floor by one wall would roll across the room and into another. An apartment upstairs from a hairdresser's shop with ceilings so low that even we could touch them, short as we both are. A room in a creaky turn-of-the-century mansion that we shared with half a dozen friends. In New York, a lovely small sublet right off Central Park West, and a floor-through part of a Brooklyn brownstone. We knew enough about money by then, however, to understand that paying rent was no way to get ahead financially. Buying a place means building equity. In 1987, I had no crystal ball to know the coming ups and downs of real estate. I did not know what replacing a bay window costs. I was, in other words, an idiot. But the herd was buying real estate, and who was I to argue with that? Sometimes the herd is right. We knew that renters were just pouring money down a hole and that we needed to start building equity. Besides, You can't go wrong in real estate, can you? After all, why do the British say that something is safe as houses? Our homes and what they taught us. We started looking for a place to